Welcome to Red Ice Radio, new and regular listeners. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and we are coming to you from Sweden in Scandinavia. You can follow us online at redicecreations.com, where we offer radio, webcasts, films, video interviews, and of course, news, frequently updated, very important stuff from around the world and beyond. We have an archive with a year of program available for you, and if you like what we do and want to get access to our full programs, both ours, or programs that has been up on our website for over a year, we encourage you to sign up with us for a membership on our website and get full access to our archives. All information about this is available on our website. And today we have a really interesting and important program ahead of us. We have Kevin P. Miller with us. He is a filmmaker who is behind the film Generation RX. And we are going to talk about the drugging of our children with SSRI drugs, antidepressants, happy pills, Ritalin, Zoloft, Prozac, and all the rest of those. And I got to say here that I think the film is really well made. Kevin has done a great job on it. It's a superb summary and kind of introduction to the subject if you're new to this kind of stuff. The website you can go to right away check out a trailer and read more about the film is GenerationRXFilm.com. GenerationRXFilm.com. So I encourage you to head on over there as we'll dive into some of these subjects here today with Kevin. So with that, welcome to the program, Kevin. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, Henrik, it's great to be with you. Thank you.
Why don't you tell us a little bit how you got started or involved in this project, Kevin, and why you wanted to go into this particular subject?
Sure. Well, you may or may not know that I've been producing documentary films for just over 20 years now. And while I was producing my first ever health freedom film called Let Truth Be the Bias, which was narrated by James Earl Jones, or some of your listeners might know him as the voice of Darth Vader, appropriately, I guess, for my film.
Yeah.
While I was doing some research for that, I came across some very rare footage from the Food and Drug Administration here in the United States. And the year was 1993, but the footage was from 1991. And it was quite startling, Henrik. It was basically a bunch of Americans, 40, 50, 60 Americans, who were lining up before a panel hearing on the drug Prozac. And so they stood before their government, they stood before the FDA, and started telling horror story after horror story. One is worse than the other. And basically, the reality is that I could not use it at that time, but I committed myself that I was going to find a way to utilize that footage at some point. So finally, 15 years later or so, I was at a Food and Drug Administration hearing in 2004, and I was listening to the testimony. And it dawned on me in the middle of the testimony that, wow, I've heard this all before. And finally, in my head, traced it back to the videotape of the 1991 hearings. So when I discovered at that point that nothing had changed at that point 13 years later, I really decided then that it's far too important to let pass and that I need to produce this film now.
Kevin, why don't you just tell us a little bit about that particular clip? That's just incredible, if you ask me. This is a panel that is supposed to have knowledge, basically, about what kind of effects these kind of substances have, not only on the brain, but emotionally and so forth. But they're really, I can't remember the name of the person now, but this expert, so to speak, is really struggling to even come up with a comprehensive answer to some of these questions, right?
Wow. Well, that's actually a different part of the film, Henrik, but it is a very powerful part of the film. And that segment that you're referring to was from 11 years ago, from 1998. There were some hearings it was a conference, basically, an international conference about ADHD. And so this was held just outside at the National Institutes of Health in the United States. And they invited, quote, experts from around the world. And the part you're referring to, believe it or not, it's the son of author Kurt Vonnegut.
Hmm.
I didn't make a big deal out of that in the film, but that is rife with irony as well, that it was Kurt Vonnegut's son, Mark Vonnegut, that was making these points. And the moderator fielded a question from the press, from National Public Radio, and he basically said to the moderator, well, listen, you guys aren't even giving a description of what the symptoms of an ADHD child are like, and I'm beginning to think that it's very much like the U.S. Supreme Court's definition of pornography, which is you know it when you see it. And the moderator disagreed vehemently and turned to Dr. Mark Vonnegut, who is a pediatrician, a medical doctor, and asked him to describe some of the symptoms of a typical ADHD child.
Yeah, that's right.
And indeed, Henrik, Dr. Vonnegut stumbled and stammered and slurred his way through, you know, 3-4-5 minute answer. And it was quite embarrassing. And it was also quite indicative, I believe, of the problem that exists with ADHD and so many of these, quote, psychiatric illnesses, end quote, that are seemingly created by a vote as opposed to something based in reality.
Absolutely. And I think I can remember now what particular drug there are supposedly curing ADHD with. But of course, that is the connection here, so to speak, that
yes.
We're talking about pretty much undefinable diseases, psychological disorders and things like this. And they're trying now in different ways to basically give our kids medications for so-called illnesses and diseases that they cannot define. They cannot pinpoint what it actually is, right?
No, you're 100% correct. And the class of drugs, it's basically speed, to use the street jargon. But the term, the generic term, is methylphenidate. And people can look online. It's methylphenidate, methylphenidate. And that's the class of drug that includes Ritalin, Concerta, Adderall, basically the biggest class of stimulant drugs on the market. And indeed, you know, when I started peeling the layers back for the film and doing the research, Henrik, it was, you know, I take great pride in the fact that my films do not present conjecture, or, you know, they're based upon fact. And so many times when we get into these discussions, people like to have conspiracy conversations.
Yes.
This conspiracy theory. And I like a good conspiracy theory as much as the next guy. But the facts are the facts. And all of the things presented in Generation RX are indeed facts.
Yes.
So there is no conjecture. There is no guesswork. And what I learned was that there's the science behind these use of these psychiatric medications. And indeed, the psychiatric diagnosis is extremely shoddy. And in fact, it's the worst, it's the least scientific of all of medicine. And so it's becoming a huge problem, a problem so drastic, as I point out in the film, that the United States Drug Enforcement Administration, which is normally charged more with illegal drugs, as you well know, said in 1994 that they did a survey from 1990 through 1994, and they showed that there was a 734% increase in the use of methylphenidate, these Ritalin and stimulant drugs, just in 4 years or in 3.5 years.
Yeah.
Which a 734% increase is beyond frightening. And as you said at the outset, this is based on very shoddy science.
Yes. So in one way, what happened here, so to speak, if we talk about the increase, someone has managed to convince not only teachers and parents, but also doctors and so forth to begin to prescribe these drugs to the kids. What do you see in regards to, well, if we talk about, for instance, the different lobbies from the pharmaceutical companies and so forth, how instrumental have they been, do you think, in this kind of increase in these kinds of drugs, Kevin?
Well, there's no question that the pharmaceutical companies are the driving force behind the dramatic increases in the use of not only these stimulant drugs, but the SSRI antidepressant drugs and the, quote, so-called bipolar drugs or the antipsychotic drugs. They are the driving force behind all of it. As a matter of fact, the Drug Enforcement Administration study that I point out in the film says that they were extremely dubious of the facts being put forth by groups like CHAD, Children and Adults Against ADD, and other groups because of their heavy sponsorship from the drug companies. But it really runs even deeper than just the pharmaceutical companies, Henrik, because the fact is that, you know, as is the case in Europe, here in the United States, in Canada, New Zealand, Australia, et cetera, through most of the Western world, if you will, there is a tendency, there is a real tendency for citizens from all walks of life to basically genuflect before their doctors. And this has created a huge problem because the doctors are the people who are believing this information that's being put forth by the drug companies and these so-called studies that really aren't studies at all. And when a person who is not, I did not grow up and study in college, in university, I did not study medicine, but when I studied journalism and speech, but when someone like me, who's a layman, a layperson, can dig through these documents, look at these studies in great detail, and discern the patterns of deception, well, then you would think that doctors and medical groups of all kinds would be able to do the same and pick out the same shoddy science that I did.
Yes.
But as you well know, this is not the case.
Why do you think that is? What happened there? Are doctors simply not interested in finding out about the drugs they prescribe, or are they in some other way, if we can use that term, indoctrinated? I've heard these stories about how pharmaceutical companies are basically, in one way, bribing different doctors. That they take them out for dinner to tell them about these new drugs and so forth that they have on the market available, what it can help for. They get brochures sent to their offices by pharmaceutical companies and so forth. Do you think that that's the major, the primary way that they're doing this?
Well, I think that it's a combination of that and much more. All we need to do is look at this H1N1, which I'm sure you've covered in great detail on your fine network. And we know that in Europe, for example, people seem to be far more compliant, that they are not really as resistant to the idea that, oh my gosh, this pandemic is about to occur and we need to take these vaccinations to protect ourselves. So it's not only the doctors that have been, quote, indoctrinated, as you say, but, you know, the people themselves, we've all been indoctrinated to blindly trust our doctors over the years.
Yeah.
And most doctors are good and decent people. I'm not trying to say that there is some huge, again, conspiratorial bend on this. Most people just don't have the time to do all of this research, so they trust the information that's coming down from the National Institutes of Health or from, in many cases, the drug companies or these studies. And what's happening really in terms of taking doctors' objectivity away, Henrik, is that, you know, there's a famous study that I looked at about 10 or 15 years ago, and, you know, they queried medical students before they entered medical school. And they asked them a simple question. They said, how many of you believe that food and diet will be essential tools in your arsenal to fight disease as a doctor? And the figure that answered yes was above 90, I believe it was 98% of people, of students entering medical school thought that indeed diet and other natural remedies could be key in combating disease. Well, after the first 2 years of this indoctrination, of this initiate, if you will, that number had dropped to 18%. 18% of the people, and again, this was in the late 80s, but still it's reflective of the problem. 18% of the students, after 2 years of being initiated into the medical orthodoxy, had decided that diet was going to be a critical component in treating disease. So, you know, when we have this huge shift, then it inevitably filters down, trickles down to the people. And then you add advertising here in the United States on top of that, and it's a mass confusion, and people basically just turn over their health and that of their family to their doctors.
Yeah. If we talk about the curriculum in some of these courses and classes that many people take then who are want to become doctors and learn more about health, do you think that it could be a conspiracy there in regards to what they actually are taught?
That's an interesting question, because I had a mentor who passed away a number of years ago who was in the chemical solvent recycling business. So in other words, he was pretty much one of the good guys, right? I mean, he was recycling all the chemicals that are used on an everyday basis, you know, whether it's the corner dry cleaner or, you know, gas station or whatever it is, these chemicals that whether we like it or not are being reused all the time. And I had a huge argument with him one day over lunch, and we were talking about how the pharmaceutical companies have indeed filled the void to pay for course curriculum for, again, medical students and for scientists and for universities. So it used to be in the United States, and I would imagine so throughout nations throughout Europe, that the government would fund a great deal of research, academic research, about medicine, about potential drugs or treatments for diseases. Well, in 1980, when Ronald Reagan was elected president and this idea of, quote, smaller government came to be, one of the first things that got cut was funding to the universities. So as a result, the universities were, quote, dying on the vine. I mean, they needed funding badly. So they loosened the regulations for which drug companies and big food companies and others could invest in the curriculum and drive the curriculum with their dollars. So yes, there's been a cataclysmic shift over the last 25 years or so to private funding for research, and that indeed has severe ties to industry and in particular pharmaceuticals.
Yeah. And if we connect this with the whole swine flu issue that is going on now as well, and if we talk about some of the pharmaceutical companies, are there some similar names here that are starting to pop up when you do the research?
Oh, my God, yeah. And as a matter of fact, I have Twitter under the name Kevin P. Miller, and I do so because it allows me to track a lot of government agencies and individuals around the world that have shared interests. And one of the things that I posted back in very late February was a story out of the Times of India that you're probably familiar with now.
Yeah.
It has become rather famous, about Baxter International. And Baxter International not only had created, you know, a vaccine for the flu, just a common flu, but as you probably know, if this vaccine had been released throughout Europe, literally, the estimates are that 350,000 people minimum would have died because it was a tainted batch. Now, this is one of the same groups that is charged with making the H1N1 vaccine and manufacturing that, in addition to Glaxo and some others. But, you know, there's a lot of evidence, and unfortunately, to this point, not verifiable, that the H1N1 strain may itself have been created and released, quote-unquote, accidentally out of a Baxter International laboratory.
Yes.
So, you know, there is no question that the pharmaceutical companies, that the most powerful companies in the world, what I like to refer to them as the petrochemical companies, because let's face it, that involves it all, doesn't it?
It does.
But these companies stand to make hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars, should each of us be compliant and go get this vaccine.
I want to get into a little bit some of the reasons here, talk about the potential basically why they're doing it and what the driving force might be. We can go into money and so forth as well. But let's break down some of the, I guess, terminology. Let's say someone is totally new to this and doesn't know about SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Maybe you can tell us a little bit what that is, and is that the same as a happy pill? And maybe we can just break down some of the terms here.
Sure. Well, you got it right. The title is exactly correct, and the common term, of course, is just simply antidepressant. And you know, this rides along with the philosophy that we again touch on in the film to some measure, and that is that the problem with quote mental illness is a quote chemical imbalance. And what they're claiming is, what the drug companies and what psychiatrists are claiming, is that the cause of mental illness is a chemical imbalance, and that there's not enough serotonin going to the brain. The irony is, of course, that most of these medications actually cause chemical imbalances, as we again cover in the film, and they don't cure it. And then, of course, there's this whole array of other awful, god-awful side effects that come with taking SSRIs potentially.
Yes.
And those include very violent acts, suicide, and other things.
So what happens to the brain when we start meddling with the serotonin levels, Kevin?
Well, again, I think that part of the reason this is so important, Henrik, is because we're talking about, in the film Generation RX, we're talking about children. And of course, you know, children have developing brains until the age of 18 or 19, sometimes even 20 years old. So while the brain is developing, if you're taking a stimulant drug, it can cause the brain to shrink. Just like a stimulant drug, just like speed, can cause the heart to shrink and atrophy. So that's extremely dangerous. So when you're playing with the biochemical balance of the brain, then you're usually not only, you know, physically forcing, you know, forcibly changing the biochemistry, but you're also often robbing the brain of the very nutrients that it needs to heal itself. And so this is a very dangerous pattern, but it's one that Western medicine has been duplicating and replicating for, you know, 20, 30, 40 years now.
Do you think that's because they have found some kind of, how should we put it, a short-term solution to it, meaning that maybe they've done tests in some kind of way and come to the conclusion that, yeah, it seems to be working in some cases, maybe for, I don't know, for lab rats or something like that. And then they've applied this science to human beings. And especially when you do it to kids, as you mentioned, the effects are totally different. What do you have to say about that?
I think you're 100% right. And as a matter of fact, I had lunch yesterday with a very, very dear friend of mine who's been on SSRI medications for 12 years. And she's the sweetest woman you'll ever want to meet. And she's into yoga and she's into taking care of herself, but she's had these depression issues. Now she claims that these have helped her. Again, they've helped her. And part of the reason that we do the film is that we're not trying to tell people necessarily don't do these medications, but what the film does is we're pointing to the other side of the story. We're revealing for the first time in many instances what not only the side effects are, but what some of the shoddy science is that got these two drugs approved in the first place. So even though she believes that they've sort of helped her, she is concerned because, for example, her memory is slipping away. And she's a young woman. I mean, she's 41, 42 years old. And after being on these medications for a long time, she's noticed that her memory is slipping away. And so there's a multitude of these kinds of issues that only become compounded when you're talking about giving them to children as young as 10 and 11 years old, Henrik.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unconscionable that a child of this age should be taking these. But, you know, again, part of what I do with the film is that I think is unique is that I create this very powerful other side of the story based solely on facts. And my position is, hey, you know, if after you watch Generation RX, after everything you see, if you decide that you or your son or daughter or a loved one wants to be on these medications, well, at least now we've given you fully informed consent by which to make that decision.
Yes. The discussion needs to be balanced. That's what you're saying.
Yes, indeed.
And how, if we talk about, we talked about some of the detrimental effects on the brain, and especially for children again now then, but how are the effects emotionally if you go on some of these drugs? I've heard stories, and you bring up in your film as well, that many people, again, maybe not all them, you know, everyone is different and all this, you know, we have a different brain chemistry and so forth, and what you say might work for someone in the short term or whatever, but in the long term, and for many people, it seems to be that the emotions are kind of, how should I put it, leveled out almost. It's like if you have a depression, take this pill, and at least you're not feeling the depression anymore, but you're not going to feel happy anymore either, right?
No, it's muted emotions for sure. And one of the things that I've said to other people in the past, Henrik, is I obviously don't have, you know, Michael Moore's killer instinct, because I interviewed a woman and her son was 11, I believe, and she was a member of CHAD, the organization that's a huge proponent of drugging kids with ADHD drugs, etc. And at one point I told my cameraman to zoom in to the face of the child. And while she was talking, while mom was blathering on about how great these drugs are and they've changed her family's lives and the lives of her children, etc. And the cameraman slowly zoomed in on her son's face and kept going till he got a very tight shot to the child's eyes. And the child was stoned. I mean, his pupils were black and large and all of the things that you'd see from someone that was on a hard drug. And I didn't use that, excuse me, because I didn't want to victimize the child.
Yeah,
I felt like the child was already victimized by having this overly enthusiastic mother who thought that this was a miracle. Meanwhile, I could tell that the child was just stoned. But there's another quick story that I think really sums it up very well, Henrik, since you brought it up, and that is this progression. Let's say you put a child on Ritalin at the age of 5, 6 years old, because the teacher thinks that this child's a little rambunctious and a little, well, very much acting very much like a child in classroom.
Yeah.
So she mentions it to the parent and says, you know, you might want to go to a pediatrician or, you know, a psychiatrist or someone and get diagnosed. So they take the child, this 6-year-old child, to get diagnosed. And lo and behold, they diagnosed the child with ADHD, so they prescribed him Ritalin. So after 3, 4, 5 months, the Ritalin isn't, quote, working. So they up the dose of the Ritalin. So now the child's on a stronger dose of Ritalin. And then, you know, after a while, 6 more months go by, the child might have a psychotic reaction. I mean, just flips out. And he's talking gibberish, and his mother and father are concerned. So they rush him back to the doctor, the psychiatrist. And the doctor says, oh, my gosh, you know, rather than recognizing that this mania, that this psychotic reaction is a result, a known side effect of Ritalin or of these methylphenidate drugs, rather than recognizing that, the psychiatrist says, oh, well, the child now has bipolar disorder. So now the child has jumped from ADHD to bipolar. Now the child is put on not only Ritalin, but now the child's put on one of these dangerous, powerful antipsychotic drugs like Risperdal. And now he's on a ticket for life to mental health drugs. And we asked the question, like my friend journalist Robert Whitaker does in the film, why? Because the child squirmed in his seat at school? Is this a good system? And inherently, the answer is no.
Oh, God, it's just horrible hearing this. And you brought up Ritalin as well, and I want to ask you if you know if Ritalin still is the most prescribed drug in the U.S. I heard this a few years ago. Do you know if this is still the case?
I don't know if it's the most prescribed, but it's the most abused prescription drug in the United States. That I can tell you.
Yeah.
I mean, right now there are well over 100 million prescriptions for Prozac. And that's just for Prozac. I mean, so, yeah. And that's not counting Paxil and the other drugs, right?
Yeah.
But yes, it's still a huge problem.
So, you know, I want to touch upon this a little bit about kind of, I guess, what our relationship is to depression and so-called different disorders. Do you think that we have a healthy relationship to depression overall? We can talk about it in the context of a child or an adult. It seems to be, to me, that as soon as someone feels a little bit down, we immediately think that something's wrong and we want to go to the doctor and fix it. And it seems just screwed up, if you ask me. What's your take on this, Kevin?
I would agree with that, with one exception where I break from some of the real extreme thinkers on this issue is that, of course, I always come down on the side of medical freedom of choice as long as there's fully informed consent. But I do think that, you know, part of it is that in the past, so many, quote, mental illnesses were stigmatized. And that created an opening for the drug companies because everyone was just sort of stuck in the, you know, they put them in the sanitarium or in the madhouse, if you will. And so once they started realizing that, well, it's too extreme for some of these people, the drug companies had an opening to try to figure out ways to get this, you know, chemical into circulation as a drug. But a big part of it is, frankly, there's a direct corollary to diet and the lack of a good diet. And, you know, here in the United States, we're a little bit more libertarian, I think, about our dietary supplements than in Europe, mm-hmm. generally speaking. So, for example, we know that fish oils are very, very good for brain chemistry. As a matter of fact, they're very good for treating children with ADHD. If you get a good source of fish oil, krill oil, or just what are called EPAs, omega-3 fatty acids, they're a very good source. But there's also other things. There's dietary supplements that probably people have never heard of called phosphatidylserine. And there are other things that are just extremely beneficial. And of course, the late, great Abram Hoffer, who founded the term orthomolecular medicine and who died recently at the age of 92 years old. He was a disciple of Linus Pauling and a friend of Linus Pauling. He believed in folic acid and treating people with diet. And as a matter of fact, to tie back to the earlier story quickly about Mark Vonnegut, who was diagnosed as a schizophrenic and was living in British Columbia in a commune in the 70s, found his way to Abram Hoffer. And Abram Hoffer and his people cured him with orthomolecular medicine, something later that Mark Vonnegut, after he had become part of the initiate at Harvard Medical School, denied. He denied that he was cured by these people. And that reflected his newfound belief in the initiate of orthodox medicine.
Yeah.
So, you know, diet has a huge role to play in this. And people don't acknowledge that, but all evidence points that it's very true, Henry.
Absolutely, and I think you're absolutely right in regards to diet and overall the amount of, you know, sugar the kids get and so forth, and just the crap food overall. And I definitely agree with you that it's a major part. What I'm also is wondering a little bit about is, well, I guess the quality of life, how things are in school these days, and what kids are learning. Is there, you know, are the kids even excited about anything anymore? It seems to me that the quality of life is dropping, and the human being is more being turned into a commodity almost than an individual. And I think that also plays a major role, that the kids kind of inherently and almost on an intuitive basis feel that things aren't quite right at this time. What do you have to say about that, Kevin?
Well, I you know, you show great wisdom. I'd say that it's different in some ways in different societies. I love Europe. I travel to Europe often. If I could, and hope to someday to have a flat or two in various places in Europe, whether it's in Holland or elsewhere. And I noticed that there's more physical activity and there's more people that are walking and, of course, taking buses and not getting in their car and driving 3 minutes away and the rest like we do here in the United States. But there are certainly quality of life issues, and there are things that, you know, there's 500 cable TV stations now.
Yeah.
And there is little incentive anymore to, we have an educational system, at least in the United States, that's based on concepts from the 1950s. Desks all lined up in a row and children who are creative or quote disruptive in any way, shape or form are outsiders and meant to be dealt with. And so I see that's where the biggest shift, Henrik, in my opinion, has gone, is that, you know, I find it odd. I'm 51 years old, so I obviously was right in the heart of the whole pot and drug era. I was only 12 in 1968, so, I mean, but still in the 70s, of course, you know, marijuana and 80s cocaine and all the rest of this use.
Yeah.
So I look around at my fellow parents, and I cannot believe the hypocrisy of this age, because they're the very same people that were going out at lunchtime from their high school and smoking a joint or maybe doing speed or in the 80s doing cocaine are the very ones that are now acting like Puritans and putting their children on ADHD drugs like Ritalin in order to control their behavior. So I find it a really sad, hypocritical notion that is very prevalent here, at least in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we talk about psychiatry a little bit, maybe you can even define that. Do you think that that is the same as psychology? And is psychiatry the main thing to blame here, so to speak, in regards to kind of inventing these diseases, Kevin?
Well, I will say this. I think that what is really apparent to me, again, I'm very proud of my research. I did a film prior to this on Codex Alimentarius. It's the only film on Codex in the world. And I had 2 months to produce it. And you can imagine how many layers deep those issues went, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
The Codex Commission, the World Health Organization, the World Trade Organization, learning about free trade agreements and their effects and all the rest. So I was very proud of the information that I put forth in that film called We Become Silent. And equally so, if not more so, with Generation RX, because what I've uncovered is that, truthfully, we've given psychiatry a free pass. In the old days, even in the 60s and 70s, there was a real dedication by researchers, again, at the university academic level, a real dedication and pride in getting it right, getting the answers right. And in psychiatry, clearly the science is so inadequate, and it's so full of guesswork. And then you compound that, these very shoddily written and executed studies, with the conflict of interest of people that are sitting on a panel of something called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders here in the United States. It's the Bible for mental illness. And you compound that by a minimum of 56% of the people sitting on the panel are deciding which drugs are approved and which aren't approved. A minimum of 56% of those people had a conflict of interest with the drug companies, meaning the drug companies hire them to go out and give speeches on behalf of their drugs. And that's a minimum of one conflict of interest. And in many cases, Henrik, I found people with 7, 8, 10, 15 conflicts who were sitting on the DSM panel and approving antipsychotic medications or schizophrenia medications that had clear conflicts of interest.
Yeah.
So we've given psychiatry a free pass. Not only have we let them get away with shoddy science, but now on top of it, we're letting them pad their own pockets by getting drug money on the side. It's really abhorrent.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you think that because I don't consider this to be true psychology. People aren't getting psychological help. They're getting appointments with a psychiatrist for a few minutes, and they define the disorder and prescribe a pill for it or whatever. But
yeah, no, you are so right, and I'm glad you rephrased that, because I completely understand where you're coming from now. Yes, I would say that out of the psychologists that I interviewed and many others, who some of whom appear in the film, what including Alvin Poussant, the African-American sort of trailblazing psychiatrist from the from Harvard, they all decry the fact that there is no, quote, talk therapy anymore.
No.
And this is clearly a huge problem. I mean, when we have psychiatrists who, by my estimation, shouldn't even be given an MD title, a medical doctor title, I don't believe that they should be given that title at all. And yet they are given that. So that allows them to prescribe these drugs. And yet everyone that talks about behavior modification and the rest, hey, I had an interest in sociology and psychology myself when I was in university. And loved studying that. And, you know, I've seen many, many, and met many, many great psychologists whom didn't talk gibberish. They really were just all about trying to help people by talking through their problems, whether it was a veteran coming home from war who had post-traumatic stress disorders, or whether it was a child. And we've completely abandoned that, and we've lost that, and we are the worst for it.
It's just horrible, you know. And the question as well here that comes up is kind of what we're being, I guess, turned into. Again, I go back to that statement about the we're more of commodities. We're almost like, I heard another documentary, actually a BBC documentary produced by Adam Curtis, and in there was also a psychiatrist or psychologist interviewed, and he explained this view that many people had on themselves, that they expect themselves to be fixed if they get a problem, almost like they view themselves as a car or something, that we're supposed to function in society, and all we can do is go to the men in the white coats and get a tune-up, so to speak, a quick fix. And that view overall is to me just incredible. It's awful. What can you say about that, Kevin?
Well, the great writer Henry Miller, who spent much of his life, as you probably know, in France, pre-World War II, he used to talk about why he left New York City, and that when he went to New York, what he felt as a writer, as a creative soul, was that he felt that he would look at people brushing by, and, you know, many tens of thousands of people rushing to work with their briefcases. He would look upon them as ants. And he said he realized later on that those ants were doing important work, that the ant-like people were doing important jobs that needed to be done, that he didn't have any interest in doing, but that society needed. Well, I think now we've sort of taken that idea, and that we've all become ants, and not all of us, but many of us just march in tune with whatever the government asks, or whatever medicine tells us, or whatever our leaders say is truth. And it's a radical notion to question truth, and we know this going back to, you know, every great conflict in history. And, you know, yet, when you look at the United States, some of the greatest, most creative thinkers came out of the Vietnam era when we were all questioning authority. And yet, I think, you know, we've lost that. We've lost that in every way. I was in Amsterdam I think 5 weeks before the start of the Iraq War. And I'll never forget, you know, being so complimented by a group of 20-some-odd-year-olds in a coffee shop. We had just talked for hours and hours about world events. And at the end of the conversation, they said, well, so you're Dutch, right? You live here. And I said, no, I'm an American. And they were absolutely astonished, because so many Europeans perceive us, and I think rightly to some degree, because of what happened with Bush and the war and our unthinking ways, that we all just march in lockstep with this jingoistic nonsense. And until we stop doing that with medicine, we will not turn society around. What we need to do is we need to invest in traditional medicines. We need to invest more in non-toxic therapies. We need to allow people to start small businesses and maintain them without the government slamming them down to the earth. Because, you know, there's something to these natural remedies that have been used for thousands of years. And yet, especially in Europe, they can, you know, many places in England, you cannot buy glucosamine sulfate, which is one of the best remedies for a bad knee or bad joints ever. And yet these very toxic other drugs that are killing people and ruining their liver, they get approved with a snap of a finger. So we need to listen in to Red Ice Creations and to your program, Henrik. And we need to start questioning at a root level, what is our participation in the world at large? And how can we make the lives of our brothers and sisters better in our own lives?
Absolutely. And I also want to add here that I also think that some Europeans should stop focusing on the governments in the U.S. so much and actually look at what is happening here over in their on their own continent, both in regards to the EU, how our democratic process is being ripped away, and that actually we are equally participant, not only many of the wars that are going on, but also in the shape of how our government is basically where they are going. And, you know, in one way, it's all good. It's all good to criticize, and that should be done. But there's also a lot of Europeans that are totally hoodwinked when they come to their own continent. And that's something that I see. So all this America bashing, especially, you know, if they attack the people of the U.S., because many of the people in the U.S. are one of the most awake in terms of populations, as I see it from my point of view right now, at least. And Europeans are very much behind in regards to, you know, finding out about what their governments and what their corporations are up to. So just as kind of a defense there, so to speak. And but overall, you're absolutely right, Kevin, in regards to that we should, you know, endorse a better life for all. I couldn't agree with you more.
And I think that, you know, good starting point, especially maybe we can talk about it some other time on your program, is, you know, again, this Codex Alimentarius.
Yes.
This is an extremely dangerous thing. And unfortunately, it opens the door to charlatans, some of whom emanate from the United States and call themselves, you know, various natural foundations. And, you know, if we don't start getting truth, it opens the doors to the charlatans and the people who are trying to make a buck off of everybody. And so, again, what I've dedicated my life to is perhaps I'll never have a budget like Michael Moore did, a $10 million budget to produce Sicko. But what I'm committed to is truth. And I'm committed to communicating to people all over the earth as cleanly as I humanly can. With his common sense and as little of an agenda as I humanly can, so that hopefully people will grow and learn and with me. And so it's, again, one of the reasons I'm so honored and thrilled to be with you today. Well, and I really thank you for giving me the chance.
Absolutely. Well, let's take a little break here, Kevin. Why don't you round things up for us by mentioning your website again, so people who want to find out specifically more about the Generation Oryx film, where do they go to get a copy and so forth?
Well, sure. If people just want information about the film, they can go to generationrxfilm.com. But I'd also love it, Henrik, if they would Google Kevin P. Miller. And if they do so, they'll see that my blog will come up in two different spots. And there's extensive writing on my blogs at kevinmiller.com and also at kevinpmiller.blogspot.com. So I'd love to have more European followers and people that I can interact with so we can really expand this.
Join us in our member section for much more with Kevin P. Miller. We are going to talk about the link between school shootings and psychotropic drugs. Why are kids turning violent? We discuss rewiring of the brain when you're on these drugs, and that some kids even go after their parents while others commit suicide. We talk about chemical balance and imbalance, the corruption within the FDA. We talk about Eli Lilly, for instance, government people on the payroll of pharmaceutical companies, WTO, the G20, international banking, and the rise of world government in unison with the chemical and supplemental control of the population. We also discuss the mainstream media and their role in all this, the BBC, ABC, CNN, PBS, and how the new media is rising and what needs to be done to help spread the word about these unreported issues. Go to redicecreations.com, click on Hour 2 to tune in, or on Subscribe to sign up and tune in. Consider getting a membership with us and get access to all the material that we have for you on our website. All information about this is available on redicecreations.com. And we have some more good radio coming your way soon. Nick Rosen on how to live outside the Big Brother grid. Cliff High from halfpasthuman.com will join us to talk about the WebRot project and future viewing as well. But we'll continue with Hour 2 after some music with Kevin P. Miller for Red Ice members.
All this talk of getting old, it's getting me down, my love, like a cat in a bag waiting to drown. This time I'm coming down, and I hope you're thinking of me as you lay down on your side. Now the trucks don't work, they just make you worse, but I know I'll see your face again. Now the trucks don't work, they just make you worse, but I know I'll see your face again. But I know I'm on the losing streak as I pass down my old street. And if you wanna show, just let me know and I'll sing in your ear again. Now the trucks don't work, they just make you worse, but I know I'll see your face again. 'Cause baby, I know I